Good morning.
Good morning.
So this morning, I'm going to talk about the paramitas. And this is, we're doing a retreat here, a five-day retreat, and the paramitas are kind of the theme of the retreat, so to speak. Those of us who do a meditation practice, whether we're just starting or whether we've been doing it for a while, we're entering the bodhisattva path. Which just means very simply, we're trusting that through our meditation, through our zazen, we'll begin to wake up from our fixation on our internal radio program and attain the same intimacy with life that supposedly Shakyamuni Buddha attained, that we'll be able to do that. We can do that. So these paramitas that I've been talking about, and we'll continue to talk about for a few days, are activities which help us travel on that path or through that water. The metaphor of water is used in regard to the paramitas. So yesterday I talked, the first day of meditation, it's a good one to talk about effort, the paramita of effort. And tomorrow I'm going to talk about meditation, paramita of meditation, and the next day meditation, because that's what we're going to be doing, meditating, supposedly. Supposedly. We look like we're meditating, at least. Now, whether we're actually meditating is another issue, but we look like it. Whether I'm actually planning my talks or just sitting and being open, being available, which is what meditation is. And the last day, I'm going to talk about generosity in the retreat. So in daily life, the most important of the paramitas are morality, patience, and generosity. So I'm talking about those just a little bit today. Not that there isn't some reciprocity here. Sure there is. So wisdom is the last paramita, and I'll talk about that a little bit today too. And that's supposed to be an outgrowth. If we do this, an outgrowth of practicing patience, practicing generosity, practicing meditation, practicing morality, practicing patience. And the metaphor is a metaphor of a boat. Bodhidharma talks a lot about this. Bodhidharma, he of few words. We think he's he of few words, so we pick up his book. We always think these teachers are he or she of through few words until we pick up their books. He talks about it as a boat for crossing perilous waters, the sea of suffering. We all are in a sea of suffering. As human beings, we're in a sea of suffering. And, of course, in traditional Buddhism, we're crossing from this shore to the other shore. And we just have a little rowboat. We don't have a speedboat. It's a rowboat, but we need to take care of that rowboat. We need to do our best to take care of it. For ourselves, and we need to bring other beings, other fishes and frogs and mermaids and mermen who are struggling into the boat, other humans into the boat. Even though it's a little rowboat, it's huge. There's plenty of room. But the boat is made up of these five practices, these five paramitas. And of course, when I talk about it, I say, well, yes, we say from this shore to the other shore, but it's from the other shore to this shore. That's because we're already at the other shore. We're tossed away by the other shore. So this shore is only in sight this much of the time. How much of the time in your meditation are you really here on this shore? And how much time? So it's traveling the sea of suffering from the other shore, which you get caught up by, which we get hypnotized by, to this shore. And the Paramitas are also called the go-beyonds, because we go beyond our usual idea about what generosity is, our usual idea about what morality is, our usual idea even about what meditation is. So today I'm talking about, again, generosity, morality, patience, and then wisdom as the akrut. So I'm starting with generosity. Dana. It's the only Sanskrit word I'm going to use. Like, oh, I'll probably slip in and I probably... But try not to use Sanskrit words. Just that we call this the Dana bowl, so I thought, well, I can say Dana. Not confuse everybody. So, generosity. Training. As human beings, we need training in reciprocity. As human beings. Cultures that thrive train their children in reciprocity, train each other in reciprocity, or the culture falls apart. Any culture that wants to survive and thrive has to be training in reciprocity. Give and getting. So I just got back from being with my grandsons, my grandson Ethan, who is 9, is playing tennis, and so he was doing a match. They do matches at 9, I guess so. He won his match. I don't know if he won his match. He won his game, and he went, "Yay, yay, Mom! I did it! I did it! I beat him! I beat him!" And mother was just sort of, you know, that's my daughter was just going. So then afterwards, when they got home, I heard her talking to Ethan. And she said, "Well, that's wonderful that you won. That's wonderful. But what if you hadn't won? How would it make you feel? How would you feel in your heart, Ethan, if the other kid, Samuel, had said, 'Yay, yay, yay, I'm the best'?" And Ethan said, "Not so good, Mama." And so she said, "Well, what if next time you said to him, 'You tried hard'? What if you said that next to him, 'You tried hard'?" So that's education, isn't it? Education in generosity and reciprocity, which we have to do with our children, with ourselves, with our spouses. Education. By experiencing mutual support, we experience interdependence. That's what this practice is all about. It's all about interdependence. So, in our culture, and probably European culture, or at least French culture, I don't know, we have to really work on this stuff. But some cultures have this sense of reciprocity and generosity a little more embedded in their cultures. Many of you know the story about... now that I'm getting older, I don't know if other people know these stories. So when you were a kid, did you ever hear the expression Indian giver? Raise your hand. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, most of you did. So it's still around, huh? So Indian giver. So where does that come from? Some of you even know where it comes from. So Lewis and Clark, when they went out to Oregon, they had some Native Americans help them. And the Native Americans gave them stuff, gave them a lot of stuff. And what surprised the Native Americans was that Lewis and Clark didn't give them anything back. So they said, they had an expectation they'd get something back, because Indian giving is based on a culture of reciprocity, where you give and you get. When I spent time on Lakota Reservation, any time I gave something, I got something back immediately. And not just a fake thing, a real thing from a heart. So that's a culture where generosity is a little more embedded within the tribe. And we're all these individuals who've come together from different countries, so we don't have a tribal ethos, which is good and bad. It's good and bad. But generosity in Buddhism or in Bodhidharma teaching, in Bodhidharma teaching, is not based on either the American way or the Native American way. It's based on wholeheartedly doing something. Wholeheartedly doing something completely with no expectation at all. No expectation for reciprocity, because if I'm expecting reciprocity, then there's a little hook in there. I'll help you with your. I'll join you in your work to combat racism, but you better come sit with me. That's my little hook, right? My little hook. But that's not giving. That's not giving in the big sense. When our meditation calms down a little bit and we experience those quarter seconds of quietness that I was talking about last time, we're just generous. We just give. We don't know it's giving. We don't know. And we've all experienced this sometime in our lives. But you experience it more and more as you deepen your meditation. Sometimes you experience it less and less, and you think, I should be doing it better. But that's okay. That's okay. That chattering about doing it better is just something extra. Just come back to doing it. Just come back to giving yourself. So, the analogy of the boat, generosity is one part of the boat, as each of the five are different parts of the boat. The rowboat, the little rowboat that we're in, right? We don't get to have a speedboat. We don't know a speedboat because we want to be engaged with the world as it is, moment to moment, just rowing. If we're on the speedboat, we're missing the contour of the water, the beauty of the fish, the pain in our muscles as we row. That's all life. So we're just in a little rowboat, but our rowboat, generosity, is the wood. Oh boy, the wood in the rowboat. The wood, which is light enough to float, but not so light that it floats away. Thus, bodhisattvas practice giving, but not so much that they have nothing left with which to work. So that giving has to include to ourselves, or we'll burn out. Has to include to ourselves. Has to include paying attention to our needs. Even though we think our needs are stupid or outside the norm. I mean, don't forget about the norm. The norm is this. The norm is this. And the third way in which generosity is talked about, and I heard this from a lecture by Trungpa Rinpoche many, many years ago, in which he said, and we find this a lot in the scriptures. Generosity is just about giving up your territory. That's all. Just giving up your protective mechanism that helps you feeling solid, permanent. Just giving that up. Well, I shouldn't say that's all. It's a lot, isn't it? It's a lot. Just giving it up. Just giving it up to the big C. To the big C. And a huge relief when that happens, even if we do it just for a moment, a huge relief to discover that there's no self to protect, that in fact we're not separate from each other. We're not separate. We're not separate from anything. So before I began practicing Zen meditation, when I was a young man, I had some spiritual experiences and didn't know which way to point myself, and wanted to be on a quest and was kind of confused. And I went to my Unitarian minister from my childhood, Dan Lyon, I told him what was going on with me. And he was so available. He was so available. He didn't say anything about the Bible or anything about Jesus or anything about God. He just listened to me. He just listened to me. And he empathized with my confusion, and he gave me a few kind of indirect suggestions, but not in a way that I felt anything other than his great generosity, that he was giving up his territory as a minister. And so, so I'm still grateful to him for that. You know, when people touch us in this way, that gratitude, it stays with us, doesn't it? And it comes back in times of trial and times of trouble. It comes back to us. We have, you know, in Buddhism, we shouldn't diss our emotional memory. That we've had times where we've been really generous, where people have been really generous to us. We need to call on those times for support when we're having a hard time. Call on those. Everybody in their life has had some experience of feeling interconnected due to someone's caring for them. So that's the first one, generosity, the first one I'm going to talk about today. The second one is ethical or moral behavior. Ethical or moral behavior. So ethical and moral behavior is an important paramita. It's an important paramita. And in Buddhism, in all forms of Buddhism, and in Zen specifically, we have precepts. And precepts are vows that we make to ourselves and others about how we're going to behave in a moral way. How we're going to behave in a moral way. And as a matter of fact, in Zen, giving the precepts is all about what initiation is a central part of initiation, of Zen initiation. It's a central part of Zen ordination, and it's a central part of transmission when finally the apprentice is ready to graduate. So it's a big part of it. And so I'm going to read the precepts here. The basic 10 precepts that we do here. A disciple of Buddha does not kill, but rather cultivates and encourages life. A disciple of Buddha does not take what is not given, but rather cultivates and encourages generosity. A disciple of Buddha does not misuse sexuality, but rather cultivates and encourages open and honest relationships. A disciple of Buddha does not lie, but rather cultivates and encourages truthful communication. A disciple of Buddha does not intoxicate self or others, but rather cultivates and encourages clarity. A disciple of Buddha does not slander others, but rather cultivates and encourages respectful speech. A disciple of Buddha does not praise self at the expense of others, but rather cultivates and encourages self and others to abide in their awakened nature. A disciple of Buddha is not possessive of anything, but rather cultivates and encourages mutual support. A disciple of Buddha does not harbor ill will, but rather cultivates and encourages loving kindness and understanding. A disciple of Buddha does not abuse the three treasures, but rather cultivates and encourages awakening, the path and teaching of awakening, and the community that takes refuge in awakening. So, over and over, we repeat this over and over. And Bodhidharma talked about morality as being the keel in the boat, deep enough to hold the boat upright, but not so deep that it drags the shoals or holds it back. Thus, bodhisattvas observe precepts, but not so many that they have no freedom. So, before Mahayana Buddhism, which is the type of Buddhism we practice, people who had been ordained, if they were men, had to practice and recite more than 200 precepts. And if they were women, more than 300, because, you know, there was a lot of sexism. And that's why there was a lot of sexism. So Mahayana said, well, this is a little too much. Let's get down to the ten basic, which are actually not that different from the Ten Commandments. I mean, Buddhists are always saying how they're different, but I don't see that much difference, except maybe commandment comes from some you know, super father. You got to be your own super father in Buddhism. But don't be too super about it, because it won't work. It won't work. So Mahayana then distilled them, and they said, you know, Buddhist practice, meditation practice, isn't becoming a should machine. Should, S-H-O-U-L-D. We're always, should I do this? Should I do that? Should I do this? Can't do this? Can't do that? It's about relaxing into who we are. And we have a lot of shoulds already. We don't need really any more shoulds. We just need to refine them a little bit. Notice how we're only doing them to interconnect. We're not doing them to be some righteous person. But by interconnecting, then we're upright. We're upright. On the other hand, these precepts or some norms for behavior are really important. Really important. What's happened in the Catholic Church, in the Tibetan Buddhist lineage, in the Zen Buddhist lineage. I don't know about those Protestants, but maybe they're coming next. I mean, it's horrific. It's horrific. It's a disgrace that people with this ecclesiastical authority are taking advantage of others, are using their power in some way that harms others. It's a disgrace. So we need something. We need something. And we should be pretty serious about it. Pretty serious about it. But it's for ourselves. So we should also be serious about not... Now, here at Zen Center, as the guiding teacher here, it says that I keep giving the precepts. So I'm giving the precepts to all these people. Well, okay, I'm giving them to them. But it's my own behavior. Giving them rules. What's that? What good is that? I should give them my heart. The stillness of my heart mind. That's what I want to give them. That's what I want to give them. Not some rules for behavior. Is that really going to help them be more generous? Well, I give them the rules, but I say it a little differently. Because that's just who I am. I like Gandhi's approach. I'm Gandhi's follower in regard to this. Not in regard to everything, but in regard to this. Once there lived a mother whose son was addicted to eating large quantities of sugar. She was worried about his health and tried many times to break him of his addiction without success. Finally, in desperation, she decided to bring her son to the great leader, Mahatma Gandhi, and ask him for help. When she had finally met with Gandhi and explained the situation, he said to the mother and her son, "Come back to me in 2 weeks, and I'll speak to your son then." In 2 weeks, the mother and her son returned, and Gandhi took the boy aside and entreated him, "Please do not eat sugar. It's bad for your health." The mother was upset and asked, "If that is all you were going to say, why did you not say it 2 weeks ago?" Gandhi explained, 2 weeks ago, I was still eating sugar myself. So we should be careful about this stuff, right? Be careful about this stuff. Best way, probably, to follow these precepts, to engage in moral behavior, is to, in the beginning of your meditation, or the end of your meditation, the middle of your meditation, send some vibes of loving kindness to the person you're upset with, and to yourself, and to the person you're upset with, and to yourself. Send them. So that you begin to break down the crust, the divisions within your own heart mind. And then you can return to that wonderful stillness that's here. Even if you just get it for a quarter second, it doesn't matter. It's not of time. So if we practice generosity in its most fundamental sense, we do. We do give up our little small territory. We do. And the next paramita, patience.
Patience.
So if we're going to reach the point of giving up our territory, we've got to do meditation, and we have got to be patient. We have got to be patient. The meditation that I practice and that I teach is turtle meditation. Here, some of you have heard me talk about this, maybe more than once, maybe more than twice. My teacher, Suzuki Roshi, had little turtles on his altar. Those were his Buddhas, the little tiny turtles. Because he was just a turtle. He wasn't very fast. Nobody had ever heard of him until he came to the United States at 58. In Japan, everybody knew he was just a turtle. They didn't want to hang out with him. Well, you like to hang out with turtles a little bit, but after a while, they're sort of boring, aren't they? Not much is going on. They're barely moving. Sometimes you think they're alive, but maybe they're dead. You think they're dead, but they're actually they're alive. He was just a turtle. Just a turtle. For years. He got to San Francisco, and all of a sudden people, well, I don't know, but he was still a turtle inside. He was a turtle. He got mixed up. He start one talk and forget what he's saying. He lost his glasses all the time. And once I couldn't find my glasses, and I went up to his office, and I said, I've lost my glasses. He said, really? I said, yes. And he said, what did they look like? I said, well, I can't describe them, but you've seen me wear them every day. And he said, oh. And he then went upstairs to his office above mine. He came down. And he said, are these they? I said, yes. He said, oh, I thought they were mine. So there's the mindfulness of the greatest Zen master in the world, right? Oh, you should practice mindfulness. It was a turtle. It was a turtle. But a turtle knows how to go in his shell, in her shell, and be still. Just be still. And then take one step, and then take another step, and then poke out and get a bite to eat, and then come back in the shell and rest. And then take another step, and then take another step, and then poke back in the shell, get a bite to eat when it's hungry. That's a turtle. But a turtle doesn't win. If you want to win, don't do this stuff. Don't do this stuff. Oh, yeah, still do this stuff. I'll help you. I'll help you do turtle practice. Still do this stuff. If you want to win, you really need to do this. You really need to. And, of course, we all want to win. We all want to win. And we can notice that. Just go within our turtle shell. So patience. Katagiri Roshi, the teacher here, a founding teacher, a person who ordained me, his name was Great Patience. His teacher gave him that name. He was embarrassed by it. He never wanted to use it. But it's true, he was. He was very patient. The more idealistic we are, the more we focus on the ideal, forgetting this moment, this breath, this experience, the more impatient you become, right? And we can see that in all of these different ideologies, all of these different governments, all of these different armies, all of these different religions, including the Buddhists. We can see that, how they get caught on the ideal and how they're so impatient that they're going to kill people for it. Give me a break. But we see it. And we've experienced this in ourselves, too. So we have an aspiration in Zen, an aspiration to get in the rowboat and row through the sea of suffering and help all beings. That's our aspiration. You can just stay on the shore if you want. But if you're starting a meditation practice seriously, you're making a commitment to get in that rowboat. Even though the sea is turbulent, not just to stay on the safe shore, but get on the rowboat, in the rowboat. And that's our aspiration, to get in the rowboat. And then to to have an ideal, to have an aspiration, to help people while we're in the rowboat and row to a safe place, but not to be so impatient about getting there that we capsize the rowboat. So when my son was 11 or 12, and he's now, let's see, he's now 46. I must be old. Wow. 46. So when he was 11 or 12, I think maybe that was before Valley Fair, I don't know. But in California, in Northern California, they had some incredible amusement park. I don't even remember the name of it. Some incredible amusement park. And we were going to California, and my son read about it. Now, he didn't read about it online then, because there wasn't any line. Well, now my grandkids are reading about everything online. You know? And so he wanted to spend a day at the amusement park, whatever it was. It was extra special. So this was a father and son trip, and here's a chance for bonding with my 11 or 12-year-old son, right? Cool. So I'm going to go to the amusement park with him. Not my favorite thing to do. But, you know, it's my favorite thing is to be with him. Right? To be with him, that's my favorite thing. So he scopes it out the night before, and I don't know how he scopes it. I don't remember this. And he comes up with a big list of the, you know, it's got like, I don't know, 24 rides, you know, the super this. I mean, it's a huge deal. And he scopes it out how he scopes out the 15 best ones, most important ones that Minnesota doesn't have. Minnesota doesn't have these. And it's an amusement park where you pay big bucks to get in, but once you're in, you can do anything. Right? So he's looked at. It's not going to cost you. You're complaining about money. Look at this. Okay. Right? So we go to the amusement park. I think I only have a half day. I think actually I have a whole day, but I'm not sure if I could do a whole day. So I tell him, a half day, like 4 or 5 hours. He said, but we're going to do all these, Dad. Okay. So, you know, we do all the rides, and, you know, I go on all of them with him, including the snake and the roller coaster. I never have to go on a roller coaster again. Excuse me. And all, you know, do with the bumper cars. We do the bumper cars twice because he said, with that, we have to do these twice. Minnesota doesn't have any bumper cars like these. Yeah, so we're rushing through them. One, and he's checking off his list. And, you know, and I'm getting exhausted. But, you know, and then he's kind of cries at the end because our time's up and he's only gotten through 13 of them. I said, well, Chad, we can spend a little more time. We can go the rest. I could be late for some, because I made up this other thing anyway. Well, you know, that's what, well, parents have to protect themselves, don't they? So then we did it. And then so then I came back and gave my Dharma talk. And as I remember, I talked about patience and impatience, and Jed's impatience, and how when we're adolescent or pre-adolescent, we're impatient. We want certain experiences, and we're impatient. We don't have time. We haven't learned yet. We haven't matured yet. We still have an adolescent mind. There's been research recently on the teenage mind, some brain research. It's very interesting. My wife wants me to read this whole book on the teenage mind before my grandkids become teenagers. So maybe I better read it. But as I thought about this yesterday, as I was thinking about this talk, I was thinking, well, who was really impatient there? Was it him? Moi. It was me. I was impatient with his impatience. I mean, he's a 12-year-old. This is what he wants to do. He loves it. He's into it. He wants to check everything off, so check everything off. But I was impatient. Well, maybe we were both impatient in a different way, me more in a fatherly way and he more in a pre-adolescent way. So it's not something to beat ourselves up about, just something to notice. When we think someone else is impatient, check in with yourself. What's going on with you? How are you feeling? What are you expecting? What are you concerned about? Is time running out? Does time ever run out? Well, it does. Maybe your last few seconds of life. But are you guys in your last few seconds of life? Well, maybe you are. Maybe we are. So the part of the boat, the patient's part of the boat, is the hull. The hull. The hull is wide enough to hold a deck, but not so wide that it can't cut through waves. Thus, bodhisattvas don't confront what opposes them, but find the place of least resistance. The least resistance. That's patience. We find the place of least resistance. My grandson wants to go to, what's the one that they go to here? I don't know, that big amusement park here. Then I can I do it? After, now I've done, this is how many, 30 more years of meditation since my son was, can I do it? Can I just be there with him? Appreciate his joy, even how his frenetic joy? Sometimes we're frenetic about things, as human beings too. Can we just be with our own frenetic activity? Just be with it without judging it, without valuing it. And then what happens to it? It's not frenetic anymore. Duh! Not frenetic anymore. And the last paramita is wisdom. Wisdom. Wisdom is the center of the five petaled flower, the five petals being generosity, morality, patience, effort, and meditation. Wisdom is the center. And we say at the end of the Heart Sutra, which we chant every morning here at Zen Center, with nothing to attain, the bodhisattva depends on prajnaparamita. Prajnaparamita. Wisdom. Wisdom. And prajna, I'm doing a little Sanskrit, but you know, I can't help it. Prajna, jna means knowledge. Knowledge. And pra means before knowledge. So before knowledge, that gap between our thoughts, regardless of how frenetic they are, that's where we find our peace. That's where we find our openness. That's where we find our patience. That's where we find our generosity. It's generous in that space. It's generous. So in that Heart Sutra that we chant every morning, Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, is instructing Shariputra, the hero, Buddha's hero, disciple who's a hero of transcendent knowledge. So Shariputra is the transcendent knowledge guy, and one of the primo disciples of Buddha. He's got transcendent knowledge, but he doesn't know prajna. He doesn't know before knowledge, the stillness before we think we've got something. I think we need to educate someone. I think we need to educate ourselves. And of course, there is a need to educate. We do need to educate ourselves. We do need to educate others. But if we step into that quiet space, then the education becomes something mutual. Something mutual. Not just something that I give you. Just the flow of our interaction. That's all it is. The flow of our interaction. So Shariputra, who is being addressed in this sutra that we chant, thought he'd acquired something, and so he lost his patience, he lost his generosity. So probably one of my favorite little prose poems about wisdom comes from a different tradition, the Taoist tradition, but it's also about a boat. So here it is, Chuang Tzu. Chuang-tzu. If a man crossing a river is crossing a river and an empty boat collides with his own skiff, even though he be a bad-tempered man, he will not become very angry. But if he sees a man in the boat, he will shout at him to steer clear. Some of you remember this story. If the shout is not heard, he will shout again and yet again and begin cursing. And all because there is someone in the boat. Yet if the boat were empty, he would not be shouting and not angry. If you can empty your own boat, crossing the river of the world, no one will oppose you. No one will harm you. No one will oppose you. No one will harm you. Now, people may try to harm you. That means you should pay attention. Sometimes we get in toxic relationships with people, and we should pay attention. But if we can empty out ourselves, then we know more, we better how to deal with that toxicity. It doesn't mean we don't pay attention to our own intuition, to our own needs. It means that we empty out all that worrying stuff so that we can, in openness, make a wise decision just based on this, just based on this. So that's the wisdom that arises from and is a product of generosity, morality, patience, effort, meditation, and it's transformative, but it's turtle transformative. So, meaning that don't expect any transformation, just be a turtle. Don't be expected, because the hair, our practice is not the hair practice, it's a turtle practice. And actually, we're all turtles. So, even though we always think, oh, these other people are so much better than us. All these years I've been giving one-to-ones, doksan with people, and any of you are welcome to come. I help them in their meditation, and so many people over the years think that their meditation is the worst. So many people think that only they have it, that they have this totally out-of-control mind, everybody else is sitting so still. Well, that's the human nature, I guess. It's human nature. But we can always tap into the wisdom of being before knowledge. It doesn't dis knowledge. It includes knowledge. It honors knowledge. It's just primal. It's primal. It's primary. And because we learn how to empty our boat. We just learn how to empty our boat. But it's never been our boat in the first place. So. And we have all these paramitas. Now, if we just go into the water without the rowboat, you can do that. But I don't know, the sharks will probably get you. And you need a rowboat. You need a rowboat. We need the support of others. We need lots of different practices and lots of ways to get support. The more, the better. The more, the better. So since this is a retreat, that means I don't take questions. But I hope those of you who are going off and doing your days, doing your day-to-day someplace else, have a good day. And I hope those of you who are staying here, just be turtles for the rest of the day. Or if you're doing till Wednesday. And if you poke yourself out of the shell, if you spend all the time poking around, that's okay. You've still got this shell. The shell's always there. It's always there. It's protecting you. It's protecting you. It's the paramitas. They're protecting you. Thank you.